want to tell you a story about myself this morning, but allow me to preface it by explaining something. I am prone to motion sickness. Roller coasters are not my thing. Spinning in circles is not my thing. In fact, I remember when my high school physics class took a field trip to a local park so we could study the centrifugal force by playing around on the merry-go-round. I was smart enough not to actually get on the merry-go-round, but I thought I'd be safe if I was one of the ones who stood beside it and, you know, helped spin it and get it going. I was wrong. Just watching others spin on the merry-go-round, I had to step aside, go behind a tree, and throw up. My physics teacher was mortified. Another time, I remember, before we had children of our own, I took my niece to a water park. And we went on the water slides a bunch, probably too much, because then later we were floating around on the lazy river after having been on the water slides a bunch, and I had to scramble off the tube, get out of the lazy river, and puke in a potted palm tree plant. Motion sickness is like a way of life for me. I could tell you more stories about meals lost, trips to amusement parks ruined. If I spun around in circles like 5 or 6 times right now, we'd have a problem. So all of that is preface to the story I'm about to tell you. When I went to Haiti last summer, I was nervous about the plane ride. Commercial flying isn't too bad for me. I take a couple Dramamine, the bigger jets. They're roomier. They tend to be pretty smooth. I've never thrown up on an airplane. But I heard that it was a smaller plane flying into Haiti, so I was nervous about that. Wasn't sure how that would go. And flying in turned out not to be that bad. It's the same plane, Missionary Aviation Fellowship plane. First of all, it was a bigger plane than I had pictured in my mind. So that made me feel better. And the flight from Florida, you stop in the Bahamas, into Capation, 2-3 hour flight went fine, no problem. But from Capation to Pion, it's a 12-minute flight over the mountain pass, landing on a grass runway. So that had me a little bit more nervous. And actually, that flight, flying in again, wasn't so bad. It was a little rougher, but I actually thought about my son Austin was along, and he spent most of the flight up in the cockpit with the pilots, and I almost went up and joined him. Then I thought maybe I'd be safe and not. Coming home, though, was an entirely different story. I don't know if it was because I was tired after the week in Haiti, or if it was just that much hotter when we got on the plane, or if the turbulence just was that much worse, but that 12-minute flight from Pion back down to Capation was the 12 longest minutes of my life. Something about going over that mountain pass, you know, where the plane... And this wasn't a bad flight, mind you, but you go over that mountain and the air, and the plane is kind of going up and down, and your stomach wants to stay in one place. You know how that feels, and the change in temperature, because it was really hot on the ground, and then you get up in the air and it gets pretty cool, and then, you know, 12 minutes later you're back down in Haiti and it's hot in June. And so the temperature change and the motion and my vision, I could feel my vision was just sort of starting to narrow, and I could hear the blood rushing through my head, and my fingers, my knuckles were kind of getting white as I was sort of gripping the armrest of my chair. And I did not throw up. I didn't throw up. I had the patch behind my ear and the Dramamine and everything. But I sweat. I mean, I was... We got down on the ground, and my mom was sitting next to me, and she has trouble with this a little bit, too, and she turns to me to say, well, that wasn't so bad, and her jaw just dropped open, because I looked like I had just stepped out of a shower. I mean, I have never been this soaked in my life. I mean, you could have wrung my clothes. You could have taken one of those gas station squeegees and just sort of wicked the water off of me. I mean, I was just soaked, that kind of thick, clammy sweat, you know, and not the good kind of sweat that makes you feel cool and everything, but that thick, cold, clammy sweat, because I was white as a ghost, and I was just covered in sweat. Now again, keep in mind, I'm a guy who will puke watching a merry-go-round, okay? So if you're thinking, the trip to Haiti isn't that bad. It really isn't. If you're thinking about going, I don't mean this as an advertisement for you to go, by all means, it's fine, those planes are safe. I get that, but you know, motion sickness is a way of life for me. So, and I tell you that story now, because I'd like you to start maybe think about, how does your body react when it's under extreme stress? You know, That's what was going on. It was this reaction to stress. And I also tell you that story because I think it maybe will help us get a little insight into what happens to Jesus in the story we're going to look at today. Because here's one thing I want you to know as we go into this story. Jesus is under high degree stress. Last week we started a series called 60 Hours That Changed the World. I'm calling it that because of the time markers in the text from sun down on Thursday when Jesus and his disciples sit down to Passover to sun up on Sunday morning when Jesus walks out of his grave. That's a span of just 60 hours. And in that time frame, Jesus celebrates the Last Supper. He goes to the garden and prays. He's betrayed, arrested. Peter denies him. All that, right? The cross to the resurrection. All that takes place in those 60 hours. So that's our focus as we move in towards Easter now. We're going to be looking at those 60 hours as Luke tells that story, the passion story of Luke. And last week, our clock here was set to 6 o'clock because that was the start of the Passover meal. And last week we learned that a sinister plot has been set in motion, that Judas and the Jewish officials, kind of guided by Satan, are orchestrating things so that Jesus can be quietly arrested, put on trial, and then killed. But at the same time, we saw that Jesus has a divine plan of his own, that you can't take Jesus by surprise. He knows what's coming. He knows what Judas is up to. And yet, we saw Jesus' plan and his intention to go, verse 22 says, just as it has been decreed. That's the word he used. Just as it has been decreed. So Jesus has a plan of his own. Now this week we set our clock to midnight. And I'm guessing at that. There's no time marker in the text, but it's right after the supper and Jesus and his friends have moved out to the garden. And it's after a Passover meal. And traditionally, I read this week, traditionally Passover will last till about midnight. And so we're going to say it's about midnight. It's early in the morning now. It's early Friday morning. And Jesus has gone out, as usual, Luke tells us, and that's an important word. He's gone out, as usual, to this place on the Mount of Olives. And it's important, that as usual part, because he's going exactly where Judas would have expected him to go. And while in this garden, Luke calls it the Mount of Olives. Matthew and Mark call it Gethsemane, the same place. Jesus prays. And we're going to see that Jesus is under an enormous amount of stress. The kind of stress that would make even the strongest of people break out in a clammy sweat. So here's the text. It's Luke 22. We're just going to read six verses, 39 through 44. It says, Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. And on reaching the place, he said to them, pray that you will not fall into temptation. And he withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed. And he prayed, Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. And an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. There are two things I want to show you from this text. I'll call them Jesus' agony and Jesus' willingness. That's what I want us to see this morning. Jesus' agony and Jesus' willingness. And we'll start with the agony. Jesus is suffering before the suffering. Actually, this whole story of Jesus in the garden is often called the agony of the Christ. That's based on the word Luke uses in verse 44 that says Jesus was in anguish. The Greek word there, the Greek word that's used there is agonia, which is the root of our word agony. In the original Greek, it meant something like struggle. Here it means that Jesus is under intense mental pain. The point is not that Jesus is struggling with God. We'll see in just a bit that that's not the case. But that Jesus is struggling with the overwhelming weight of what he knows is coming. In fact, verse 41 says that Jesus knelt down to pray. And that may not seem so unusual to you. We often think of kneeling as a posture for prayer. But in first century Israel, that was not the case. If you were going to pray, you would stand upright. You'd turn your face towards heaven. So the fact that Jesus is on his knees sort of indicates that he's sort of staggering under the weight of what he's dealing with. The other Gospels, Matthew and Mark, say that he was sorrowful and troubled. In Matthew, he says that his soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. So agony seems like a pretty good word. Like I said, Jesus is under high degree stress. He's suffering before the suffering. You know, his suffering's about to begin. The next 12 hours, Jesus is going to be arrested. He's going to be beaten. He's going to be scourged with a whip. He's going to have the spikes driven through his wrists and his feet, nailed to a cross. He's physically going to begin to suffer, but he's already suffering in the garden now, to the point where the weight of it nearly is killing him on his feet. There are a couple of other clues in the text to show us just how bad it was. Verse 43 says, an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. Jesus is so distressed by what's coming that God in heaven sends an angel to help. Now, some of you maybe will remember a sermon from December where we looked at what the angels saw throughout Jesus' life. And one of the things we saw then was that there's only two points in Jesus' adult life where angels are actually said to get involved in his life. Only two times. The first time is right after the temptation in the wilderness, and then the second is right here. So in other words, after Jesus has been in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights with no food, with no drink, in hand-to-hand combat with the devil, at that point God sent an angel to help him, and then again right here, where Jesus is physically as low and as burdened as he gets, that's when angels come. And of course, it's worth noting that when he's on the cross, the angels don't come. And then the other clue to just how bad this is comes again from verse 44. It says again, being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. A couple of ways that you can understand what Luke is saying here. The Greek isn't really all that clear. On the one hand, it could be, as it's written here, that Jesus' sweat was so thick and so abundant that it was as though somebody had cut him, and it was, the sweat was pouring out of him in that sort of consistency and at that sort of rate, sort of like me on my Haitian plane ride. The kind of sweat that makes you cold and clammy and makes your clothes stick to your body and makes you feel like a wrung out dish rag, what we call a flop sweat. On the other hand, Luke might be saying that Jesus was actually sweating blood. Again, the Greek isn't clear. You'll read different English translations, will have it different ways. But it's rare, but there is actually a medical condition called hematidrosis. Where the blood vessels, the tiny blood vessels near the surface of your skin, near your sweat glands, that under high degree stress, sometimes those blood vessels will sort of constrict and they will close up. And then after the adrenaline rush is over and after your body sort of relaxes, sometimes they will expand so fast that the blood will come back, that it will actually get into the sweat glands. It will come out with your sweat, onto your skin. Again, it's very rare. But there have been clinically attested to cases of like soldiers just before they go into the heat of battle, or prisoners who receive an unexpected sentence of death. Looking up this stuff on the internet, and I don't know what you can believe on the internet, but one message board, actually a guy speculated on there that one of the reasons perhaps that you don't see it more often is because people subjected to the kind of stress that it would take to make something like this happen, to make blood actually appear in your sweat, he said, typically you're under that kind of stress, your heart's going to stop before your blood has a chance to break your skin. But again, there are cases where this has been seen. And either way, whether Jesus is profusely sweating or if he's actually sweating blood, it's clear that he's profoundly affected by what's coming. To say that he was under high degree stress is an understatement. Jesus is in unimaginable agony. And the question is, why? I mean, why is Jesus so heavily burdened? What is it that has Jesus nearly dead on his feet? For a clue, I think we can find it in his prayer in verse 42. Where Jesus staggers to his knees and he says, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." Jesus prays about a cup. The question is, what exactly is he talking about? Since we've just come from the Last Supper, Jesus has just sort of instituted communion. Probably the first thing we think of is the cup that comes with the Lord's Supper. And Jesus said at that time, you know, take this, drink this, this cup represents my blood, which is shed for you. So there's a sense in which Jesus is thinking about his death. He knows he's about to die. He knows he's about to shed blood. So I imagine that would be difficult. And I can't imagine what it would be like to be a death row prisoner. To know the time and the manner of your execution. To know, you know, 24 hours from now. 12 hours from now. 6 hours from now. I die. I mean, can you imagine the pressure you would feel to know that? To know that's where Jesus is right now. He knows. 15 hours from now, he's dead. He knows that. But I think when Jesus prays this prayer about the cup, I think this is more than Jesus just knowing, today I die. As awful as that would be, Jesus knows that for him, there's something even worse coming. And I say that because of what the image of the cup represents in the Bible. See, there's a image in the Bible that this cup is used frequently in Scripture, in the Old Testament and in the New. For example, Jeremiah 25:15 says this, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said to me, take from my hand this cup filled with the wine of my wrath, and make all the nations to whom I send you drink it." Isaiah 51, verse 17 says, "Awake, awake, rise up, O Jerusalem. You have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath. You've drained to its dregs the goblet that makes men stagger." Revelation 14, verse 10, now in the New Testament, looking towards the end, the judgment, those who worship the beast, it says they will drink the wine of God's fury, which has been poured out full strength into the cup of his wrath. You see the connection between those verses? The cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's fury. To me, these verses sound like the line in the battle hymn of the Republic, which is where that line comes from, where it says he's stamping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. This biblical image of the cup is a symbol of God's anger towards sin. There's a long biblical tradition that says the day of the Lord is coming. And on that final day, the great day of judgment, the holy righteous God is going to pour out all of his anger. It's going to be like he's emptying a goblet of all of his anger towards sin in punishment upon the earth. Remember, God's a holy God. God does not sin. God, as the righteous judge, God cannot overlook sin, because if he were to sit in judgment and sort of pass sin by, he would in a sense become complicit in that sin. And so as a righteous, holy judge, God must be angry towards sin. He must come in punishment of that sin. And now as Jesus kneels in the garden, he's in agony because he knows he's about to go and take that punishment. That's what he's praying about when he prays about the cup. He knows he's about to not just die, but he's about to receive all of God's righteous, holy anger directed against all of the sins in the world. It's all about to be poured out on him. Is it any wonder that he's in agony then? Is it any wonder that he's staggered to his knees? If you'd like to have a picture in your mind, the picture would be a picture of Jesus sitting at a table. And in front of him is this cup. And in this cup is the most vile, noxious, putrid poison you can imagine. And it pops, and it hisses, and it foams, and it's like a thick green slime, and it reeks of sulfur and burned flesh. And this cup represents all of the righteous anger of a holy God directed against all of the sins that have ever been committed, all of the sins that will be committed, and God's punishment of those sins. And Jesus is going to drink that cup. That's
what has Jesus on his knees in the garden. Jesus is going to drink the wrath of God so that we don't have to. You get how terrible this must have been? You see why he's suffering before the suffering even starts? Maybe we've heard it so many times before that we've become sort of, you know, callous to it. You know, we hang crosses up in the back of our churches. We wear them as jewelry around our necks, and we sort of forget what that cross represents, that the cross represents nothing less than the separation of God the Son from God the Father. And the cross, what Jesus is going to experience on the cross, nothing less than the hell that we deserve. You want to know how horrible it would be for you to pay for your own sins? Just look at Jesus in the garden. Look at Jesus on his knees with angels attending to him, with blood breaking the surface of his skin, just in anticipation of what he knows is coming. And you get a sense of what it would be like for you to bear the weight of your own sins. We've heard it over and over again, the wages of sin is death, but those words take on a vastly deeper and more personal meaning in the light of Gethsemane. Do not esteem the cross of Christ lightly. Do not take it for granted. Jesus drank the wrath of God for you. That's why Jesus is on his knees in the garden. He's about to pay a price too terrible for words. But I don't want you to think, because he prays this prayer, that he's chickening out. Because not at all. I mean, he's not chickening out, okay? Because the second thing I want to show you here is the willingness of Jesus to pay this price. We need to see that Jesus was willing to take this cup. So go back to verse 42. Jesus says, Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. When Jesus asked his Father to take the cup from him, it's not like he's trying to wriggle out of his duty. The suffering of Jesus in the garden is not because some will say, you know, that he's engaged in this divine wrestling match with God. That's not the case at all. There's no sense in which what happened at the cross happened because God sort of wrestled Jesus into doing something he didn't want to do. And I say that because of the way Jesus prays. When Jesus says, not my will, but yours be done. Essentially what Jesus is doing is he's echoing the prayer he taught us in the Lord's Prayer, where he says, when you pray, pray thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now Jesus is taking that same prayer and using it himself. W. Bingham Hunter, in a book called The God Who Hears, says this about that phrase, thy will be done. He says, thy will be done is not a prayer formula, but an attitude. It's a reflection of the petitioner's willingness to admit that the Father's knowledge is more complete than his children's. It expresses the child's wish to learn to want what God gives. And the last line, I think, is the key. That to learn to want what God gives. Jesus knows there's the divine plan. He knows that this plan is going to result in glory for himself and glory for the Father. So he submits himself to that plan and declares his readiness to obey it. So even in the midst of the terrible agony, he places himself squarely in the Father's care, and he expresses a willingness to want what God gives. Taken as a whole, then, I understand Jesus' prayer in verse 42 to go something like this. Jesus is saying, Father, if there's another way, if it'd be possible for us to save humanity in another way, then I'd be open to exploring that. But he says, Father, whether you want to do that or you want to do what's coming, he says, either way, I will do what you ask me to do. Jesus prepares for what's coming by entrusting himself to the Father's care. He faces the horror of the cup by believing that his Father knows best. And you see this trust and submission and obedience illustrated in the narrative of the arrest that comes next. Read the next several verses in Luke, and you kind of see Jesus' willingness. So start at verse 45. It says, when he rose from prayer, he went back to the disciples, and he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow.
Why are you sleeping? He asked them. Get up and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. And while he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus asked him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? And when Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. But Jesus answered, no more of this. And he touched the man's ear, and he healed him. And then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, the elders who had come for him, am I leading a rebellion that you've come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns. Your Savior was not taken kicking and screaming to the cross. He went willingly, obediently, knowingly. In fact, in the Gospel of John, when one of the disciples cuts off the servant's ear, and John tells us it was Peter, which isn't a surprise, when Peter cuts off the servant's ear, Jesus says, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Jesus really did lay down his life. The second chapter of Philippians, when Paul says that Jesus became obedient to death, I mean, that this is what he's talking about in Isaiah. When Isaiah looks forward and he prophesies and he says about the Savior that he will not open his mouth, that he will led like a lamb to the slaughter, yet like a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Here's the remarkable thing. Jesus knew what lay ahead of him. He knew about the abandonment and the torture and the cross. Worse, he knew that he was about to bear the penalty for all of the sins of the world. The dread of it nearly killed him on his feet. He's gone through agony just to get to this point. And yet when the bad guys show up, he goes without hesitation, without fight, without a hint of resistance. So here's the main point today. If the degree of Christ's suffering in the garden reveals the horror of the penalty that must be paid for sin, that is, if the anguish and the staggering and the sweating blood and the angels in attendance help us to understand just a little bit of the horror of what it means to drink the cup of God's wrath, if we can just get a hint from Christ's suffering before the suffering of how bad it is, then know this, Christ's willingness to go and pay that penalty reveals the depth of His love for us. Because that's why He went. He went for you. He went for me. He went so that He could reconcile a sinful humanity, so that He could take these precious creatures created in His image that had been separated from Him through the intervention of sin and all of the wickedness of the world. And He went so that He could bring precious creatures like you and me back into a loving relationship with His Father. That's why He went. Knowing what He knew. Knowing what was coming. Knowing that He's going to face God's righteous wrath on our behalf. Bleeding before He even begins to suffer. He went willingly and knowingly. Oh, how He loves you. Oh, how He loves me. He gave His life. Finally, I looked for a neat and tidy way for this sermon to end. Tried to find some ribbon that runs through it all that I could kind of wrap it up and tie a nice bow on it, send you home with a couple lessons, maybe a couple points of application. I could talk about, you know, Jesus' model prayer. I could contrast Jesus and the disciples. You know, Jesus is praying, they're sleeping. Talk about that. I could talk about Jesus' willingness to do what the Father had commanded Him to do and how that's a model for us of obedience. I could talk about that. It's in the text. But I don't want to end this message talking about what we should do or how we should act. I don't want to end this message talking about us at all. I want us to finish with our eyes squarely fixed on Jesus.
I want us to face squarely His great love for us. Again, looking at the suffering before this, I've just been humbled this week again by just the depth of Christ's love, His willingness to go through this for us. And to think that He did so knowingly and willingly is just astounding. Sometimes a sermon doesn't have to have a grand plan of action. Sometimes there doesn't need to be a challenge or an application for us all to go and work on during the week. Sometimes there doesn't need to be a ribbon to tie it all together. Sometimes it's enough for us just to come to the end of a sermon and look at the Lord and say, how marvelous, how wonderful is my Savior's love for me.